You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by James Forsyth and Cindy Yu. Now, today there's been a bit of rumblings of a U-turn by the government over the free school meals saga. Listeners will remember all last week they sort of went to war with Marcus Rashford over whether free school meals should be provided over the half-term break. James, do you think those rumblings are going to come to anything, or do you think the government is very much set still on sort of not moving on the free school meals policy?
So what Boris Johnson said this morning, he says that ministers will make sure that we have no children in England who go hungry this winter and then carried on, certainly not as a result of any government inattention. He's also said that the best way of dealing with this issue is by sending more money to local councils and putting more money into universal credit. So essentially you won't see a repeat, I don't think, of the kind of voucher-based school meals system, but I think there will be increased provision this Christmas. I think that was inevitable because this half term is not a particularly emotionally resonant half term. But the idea that of children going hungry at Christmas, it is one of the oldest themes in Christian literature. The Dickensian accusations would have just come flying thick and fast. And I also think there's another thing here, which is lots of people say, oh, governments can't be seen to bow down in the face of kind of celebrity activism. Marcus Rashford's activism is different from nearly all the celebrity activism that you normally see. First of all, this is about something in his direct lived life experience. Secondly, he puts his money where his mouth is. You know, he himself donates, volunteers, does all of these things. And thirdly, normally with celebrity activism, you know, we all know the news cycle. So-and-so says something about climate change and then takes private jet to blah. I mean, it's a cliche, but there's a reason it's a cliche. There's some truth to it. He's obviously not in that scenario in that he's not a kind of bling-tastic footballer. He's obviously someone who, with a kind of social conscience, who cares about this issue. One of the things everyone's talked about during this pandemic is, you know, normally great moments of collective action, like you saw it actually in the first lockdown, they normally took kind of a leftward turn in politics. If you go back and think, you know, not to misquote AJP Taylor, you know, before World War One, the state in Britain was really quite small. The combination of World War One and then World War Two are what made the state so much bigger, because you came out of the war and, you know, in World War One you had a land fit for heroes to live in, World War Two you had the Beveridge Report. And the kind of question, I suppose, which everyone's been kind of playing around with, which is, you know, post-COVID, how does society and the state change? And I find it hard not to think that there won't be a move to the left in certain respects. I also think one of the problems the government has is the government is spending so much money at the moment. It is much harder to say why you can't spend money on this or that, because the government is choosing to spend money on trying to keep people in work, for example. And so I think all of those lines have become harder and more blurred. And I think the question I think that no one quite knows the answer to is how much to the collective does society turn? And how much is there an opportunity to use David Cameron's phrase? You know, David Cameron used to argue, you know, there is such a thing as society, it's just not the same thing as the state. Can you find a way to take people's, you know, feelings about collective action, which have undoubtedly, I think, been heightened and raised by this pandemic, and use them to make that argument that, yes, there should be more volunteering and more help, but this doesn't all need to be state done?
And I don't think there's, it's an interesting question, I don't think there's anyone who really believes that if the free school meals policy comes in now, that it will be cancelled once the pandemic is over, I think. Is that you're sort of saying, like, once it's in place, you can't sort of come back from that?
Yeah, and I think there is a valid argument about how best to do it. I mean, I think that, you know, I think in a way there is undoubtedly an argument that with some of these most vulnerable children, and given the effect the pandemic has had on learning, it would be better to be getting these kids into school and feeding them there and doing a bit of remedial work with them. But, you know, again, that's another separate question. You know, I think that Boris Johnson's comments today show that they realise they need to change tack on this.
Yeah.
Plus, the kind of Christmas question does make it so much more difficult. But then you get into that question about, you know, how do you reach the most difficult to reach people.
Yeah. And James, I wonder why you think that the government is in this situation again after pretty much hitting the same wall over the summer. I mean, it doesn't seem like a huge amount of money, and they're being beat over the head by the £12 billion for test and trace figure. The Conservative MPs are now coming over out left and right saying, oh, I shouldn't have voted that way. Well, maybe say that last week. And Bernard Jenkin as well is saying we shouldn't have done that. So why is the government...
I think the reason they got in this trouble was that the previous justification was that schools weren't there. Schools weren't open. And so it was harder to distinguish between term time and non-term time in a period when schools aren't open. And also, because schools weren't open, schools couldn't see which children were most in need of help. So therefore, a kind of blanket policy was more sensible. I think what the government had hoped it would be able to argue was that it has given councils more money. Schools have now had the chance to see pupils and see how families are coping with the stresses of this pandemic and work out what to do next. I think when Bernard Jenkin said yesterday they'd misjudged the mood of a country, it's very hard to argue with him. But it's very hard to argue that that's not right. People are still very much in a phase where people support the state doing more for these, you know, for the people hardest hit by a pandemic, and particularly obviously children.
And when you see last week Nigel Farage agreeing with Labour MPs over the policy, then you know that maybe something's going slightly wrong here, and there's sort of warning bells going off. But yeah, I think the last thing the government wanted last week was to have sort of ministers and MPs sort of suggesting that this sort of policy was going to lead to money being given to crack dens and drug dealers. And it's sort of come back to a wider point, doesn't it? I think Isabel mentioned this on Coffee House last week, that the Tories really struggled to talk about food poverty in a good way, and they don't seem to have sort of found their voice.
The most astounding intervention was from Sally and Saxby, the North Devon MP, suggesting that any business that was giving free food to children eligible for free school meals during the holidays was obviously not in need of any more government assistance, so they shouldn't ask for it. I think the government was in the wrong place, and its position was made worse over the week, compounded over the weekend, by some of its MPs kind of taking kind of positions that opened the government up to ridicule. And I think the case was things that almost sounded kind of morally offensive.
And James, meanwhile, if there's optimism in the papers about a trade deal with the EU, it looks like that Michel Barnier has decided to stay in London. So is that white smoke or too soon to say?
No news is clearly good news at the moment, which is if both sides thought the talks were heading for failure, there'd be much more briefing out of kind of, oh, this side won't move or that side won't move. I always think there's a practical problem, which is moving all these negotiators between London and Brussels. It's obviously quite challenging to do that in a particularly COVID-compliant way, especially considering that Belgium is and Brussels are badly hit by COVID. You know, actually, even worse hit, I think, at the moment than London is. But I think that the lack of noise, which has been quite telling since these talks resumed, is, I think, a sign that they are making some progress. But again, we kind of wait to see what the kind of final outcome is, but I think things are clearly in a better place than not. I also think that all the other incidental facts arguing in favour of a deal are growing. You know, it is clear that not just Britain but Europe as a whole is having to deal with a resurgence of COVID. Do you really wish to layer a no-deal Brexit on top of that?
On that timings issue, there was a really interesting Observer piece over the weekend where Ivan Rogers, the former Brexit Mandarin, made comments to the paper saying that the UK is essentially waiting for a deal until they see who wins the American election. What did you make of that?
I think that is overstated. I think there is undoubtedly an appreciation that no deal, with all the implications that that would have given the clauses in the internal market bill for the Irish border, would make relations in the early months of a Biden presidency even more difficult than they otherwise would be. But I also think that one thing I think is true, I don't think number 10 is as gung-ho about a trade deal with the US as some people think. I think they are aware of politically how difficult it would be. Just look at the kind of constant campaigning and the Mail titles about food standards. It's not a straightforward sell. And I think there would undoubtedly be a kind of Tory rebellion if there was kind of clawing chicken and all this. I think for a long time, people in the top of government have long thought that the most likely way to get a trade deal with the US was this rather indirect route, which is if the US were to rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the hope would be that the UK would either have joined by that point or would join. And somehow I think that the feeling is that the food standards issue there, although the TPP would contain some similar provisions, because people find Australian hormone-treated beef less offensive than US hormone-treated beef. So it would be more difficult there. And also there's a greater rationale because if you were joining TPP, you could almost portray as joining a kind of economic NATO against China. But there's, you know, that there is a greater strategic purpose to this. I think that's actually been a thought for quite some time. Now, I don't think one of the early acts of a Biden presidency will be to join TPP. I think, you know, if you look at the states that have now become the new swing states in US politics, those old Rust Belt states, trade is not the most popular thing in the world in those places. And I think a Biden administration would go slowly on that. And you know, it's on the record as saying that it would seek better terms. It wouldn't want to join TPP simply on the terms that Obama negotiated and that Trump pulled out of it. It would want better terms for the US than that. So that would obviously take a long negotiation.
I mean, even if Trump won in this sort of ideal scenario here, which is that so Trump wins and on his first day saying, great, the first thing we're going to do is strike a trade deal with the United Kingdom. There are still a lot of barriers, aren't there? For example, like the US Congress could stall it, or, you know, and he's not a president with a high attention span as well. And he could focus on other things, I presume.
Yeah, you'd likely have a Democratic-controlled House. That would still cause complications. I also think that, you know, in a kind of full-blown trade deal, the US is unlikely to surrender its usual agricultural asks, partly because the agricultural lobby is very powerful. Washington agricultural states are disproportionately represented in the Senate, but also because they wouldn't wish to set a precedent. So I think you can overstate how much importance number 10 plays on a US trade deal. I don't mean for them this is a kind of definitive thing one way or the other. I think that, you know, I think also the honest truth about this US election is that there isn't an unambiguously good result for the UK either way. Boris Johnson will find the first few months of a Biden presidency, as we talked about in the Saturday podcast, he's going to find that awkward and difficult because Biden's concern will be repairing relations with those countries that are most damaged under Trump. It's going to be EU, France, Germany. I think the UK will feel quite left out in the first 6 months of the Biden presidency. But Trump is a very difficult diplomatic partner to have. You know, not only does he cause you kind of, he causes you trouble in your domestic politics, he also makes putting together kind of broad Western coalitions on issues more difficult. He's in kind of inherently unpredictable. And yet, ultimately, the UK needs the rules-based international system, which Trump is not the world's biggest fan of.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Cindy. And thank you for listening.
And John, if I can add, we have just released a podcast survey for all you keen podcast listeners. So if you can go to spectator.co.uk/podcast survey for a chance to win a bottle of Paul Roger, you can tell us what you think about the podcast, how you came to us, and what you think about the magazine as well. So that's www.spectator.co.uk/podcast survey. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks.